for Light, and this is The Connection. Our guest, the British science writer Matt Ridley, sees the rapidly unfolding book of the human genome as a series of stories that's going to tell us almost everything about who we are as a species and how we got that way. If you wrote out the entire human genome, it would be as long as 800 Bibles. Matt Ridley's new book is a lot more succinct. It's called Genome, the Autobiography of a Species in 23 Chapters. He devotes one chapter to each of our 23 pairs of chromosomes, and he uses each chromosome to explore a different facet of what makes us human. He explains what our genes can tell us about our evolution, our intelligence, our diseases, our personalities, our behavior to a great extent, and in so doing, he raises all sorts of interesting questions, from genetic therapy to whether or not we really have what we think of as free will. The background, the bigger theme underlying each of these stories is the complicated interplay between our genes and our environment, the incredibly complex feedback loops of this nature-nurture relationship combined with genetic recombination and mutation. It seems to determine how we evolved as a species. It distinguishes us from each other as individuals. We're talking about what the human genome is going to tell us about ourselves this hour. Connection listeners, what would you care to know about your own genetic story? The phone's 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Matt Ridley, welcome. We love this book. You aren't shy about saying this is, we're approaching with the publication of the genome in the next year, 2 years, 3 years perhaps, the greatest pinnacle of human self-understanding in all our history.
I'm afraid I've been as bold as to say that. I think that in reading the book, the manual, the recipe of our own species, we're actually adding more to knowledge than we've done in all the last millennium about self-understanding. It's that fundamental and that basic. Of course, it's not the whole answer. There are other ways of understanding ourselves than through our genes, but it is an extraordinary cornucopia of knowledge.
Pry open that book. What is it going to look like? What's it going to look like? I mean, people say it would take what? Hundreds of pages of the New York Times, but in effect it's going to be out there.
That's right. It's going to fit on a compact disc, and of course one of the interesting things is that if we'd done this 50 years ago, it would literally have had to sit gathering dust on a shelf in 800 volumes. But because we can fit it all on a compact disc now, because it's dumped into the internet as it's discovered this sequence, so people can search it, they can look for motifs that crop up again and again, they can start to classify genes to work out what they're doing, they can start to pick up coincidences about how one gene, it seems to be involved in some behavioral process, but actually it has a similarity to a different kind of gene and so on. They can pick up cross similarities between species. One of the fascinating things that we're already finding is the degree of commonality between ourselves and chimpanzees, even fruit flies.
Yeah, you say in the book that we are more closely related to chimpanzees than chimpanzees are related to orangutans, for example, or whatever.
Or gorillas, yeah. No, the two most closely related apes in the ape family are the chimp and the human being.
But now what does that tell you, really?
Well, it tells you that our common ancestor lived more recently than the common ancestor between the gorilla and the chimp, for example, or the gorilla and the person. Now, you couldn't have found that out from the fossils or from the anatomy of the living animals. It doesn't appear that way. But if you look at the genes, it's an unambiguous story, because the genes accumulate differences over time, and we are 98% chimpanzees. Now, people say 98% chimpanzees, that's ridiculous. I'm not a 98% chimpanzee. I'm completely different. But in fact, if you think about it, starting from a blob, from an amoeba, to make a chimpanzee and a human being, it is about 98% of the things you'd have to do would be the same.
2% difference is a whole lot of difference.
That's right.
But, you know, we talk about this kind of stuff all the time. Stephen Wise has written a book on that point, saying, among other things, that chimpanzees ought to have rights. They shouldn't be used in medical experiments. They shouldn't be sickened unto death with AIDS viruses. They ought to be recognized as legal entities. That's another whole argument that's going to come out of this process. What are you going to get out of it? What do you expect to learn usefully for your own life out of the genome?
Well, I think, I mean, there are three sort of three categories of knowledge you can get out of this. One is the medical applications. You can actually diagnose your future diseases and perhaps in some cases prevent them and in other cases cure them. I think a cure for cancer would be the big prize from this work. There's no question about that. And in fact, it was one of the motives for starting the project in the first place. The second thing is ethical dilemmas, ethical implications. I mean, you can imagine that you would use this knowledge to tinker with your offspring, to do designer babies, things like that, scary things, and those are the ethical implications we have to wrestle with. But the third thing is much more neutral, and that's just simple mystery, simple knowledge, knowing about creatures that lived hundreds of million years ago, because it's a sort of autobiography, it records what happens. Getting to grips with how embryos develop from shapeless eggs, it seems to me a huge expansion of knowledge in the clearing of ignorance that we make in the forest of ignorance, if you like. In that sense, that's to me, that's the real excitement, is self-understanding.
Yeah, let's come back to medical applications and the ethical dilemmas, but just under the heading of simple knowledge, I'd like you to explain what it's going to tell us about evolution, how we got here. But I'd also like you to wrestle with this question of what it does and doesn't determine. I mean, we've accepted for a long time that that the color of your eyes is determined by your genetic history. But until very recently, there's been a very hot argument about what your genes determine in terms of social behavior. When E.O. Wilson, who's often on this program, first said that social relations, social rank, social performance, social role was substantially guided in the human kingdom, as in the bee and ant kingdoms, by genes, a lot of people were shocked. A lot of eminent scientists, including Stephen Jay Gould, went at him hammer and tongs. What will we learn about how much of our personalities, our sexuality, our, you know, Republicans and Democrats, our performance in public life is determined by genes?
Well, one of the things that we've done up till now in the last tens of years or something is to pin down the degree to which things like that are inherited, heritability studies. And they've got much more sophisticated using twins and adoption and so on. But they're an indirect route to answering that question. A much more direct route is going to be to actually start looking at individual genes and understanding how... I mean, a lot of the objection to the idea that there might be an instinctive basis to sexuality or to the way people's personalities develop, a lot of the objection to that comes from a sheer sort of incredulity. How can a little, you know, molecule of DNA possibly determine the way I think?
The shy gene or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a ridiculous idea. And, of course, it's never going to be that simple. There is not going to be one shy gene. There's going to be environmental interactions, gene-gene interactions, and so on. Nonetheless, you can actually now... I mean, there is a gene that is known, and it comes in several varieties, and according to which variety you've got, you have a slightly different personality. You're more outgoing, more adventurous, or more shy, more cautious. Now, it's not the entire explanation of those two things, of course. But even therapists who work on shyness and things like this are now beginning to recognize that telling people actually it's innate, it's not a product of your upbringing, it's not socially determined, it may well be genetically determined, is a better way of approaching therapy for extreme shyness. And of course the difference between genetic determinism on the one hand and the environment is not a difference between Calvinism and free will, it's a difference between two different kinds of determinism. They're both just as deterministic.
What do you mean by environmental interactions? How do genes and experience feed back on each other, for example?
Well, a good example is memory, I think. We now know that memory involves the switching on of, that laying down a memory in the brain involves the switching on of about 17 genes, something like that. We found them in fruit flies. We found they're pretty well the same in us, certainly in mice. And you knock them out, you interfere with the memory process. You actually have to switch these genes on as you're laying down the memory. But it's not the genes that's determining the behavior there. It's the behavior that's determining the genes. And that, I think, is a fascinating and important insight that we've got to understand, because it turns the whole nature-nurture debate on its head.
Explain.
If I remember a phone number, what I'm doing is consciously deciding, as it were, to take an action which will switch on some genes in my brain. Now, those genes are therefore at the mercy of my behavior. So the arrow of cause and effect is not going from genes to behavior, it's going from behavior to genes. Now, often it goes in the other direction too, you know, so that you get these feedback loops, which means that the concept that genes are the puppet masters and we are the puppet just doesn't make sense, because the puppet is sometimes pulling the strings.
Is this the free will argument?
I think
all over again?
I think it is. I think somewhere, I'm not a good philosopher. I don't understand the philosophy, philosophical arguments about free will. But somewhere in that kind of process is where you escape from the dilemma that either our actions are determined, in which case there's nothing we can do about them, or our actions are random, in which case there's nothing we can do about them. That's called Hume's fork, I believe. And it's a dilemma that's troubled philosophy for a while. And it seems to imply that free will is an illusion. But I don't think it has to be.
Matt Riley is our guest. He's written a book. It's a sort of a preview of what he says will be the most important scientific book of all time, the book of human chromosomes and genes. It's being readied, in effect, for print even as we speak. He says it'll be the most important revelation of who we are, how we got here, how we operate, that science has ever produced. The phone's 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Can we cope with this sheer volume, this ocean of revelation about ourselves? 1-800-423-8255. I wish you'd just get back into the sort of behavior question, social roles. What's the Gilbert and Sullivan line about, in effect, every little first child born alive is either a liberal or a conservative? Are we going to find that in the genome?
I think that's pretty unlikely. I think there's going to be certain things we're going to find that the environment trumps nature, as it were. There are, you could find sort of pushes in certain direction that your personality might be more inclined to favour one political viewpoint or the other. But I think it's most unlikely we're going to end up deciding at birth that someone is preordained to be a car mechanic and a conservative and all those kind of things. I think there's a lot more flexibility than that.
What about the sociobiology whole idea that social roles are inherited? That that the whole species, in a certain sense, has a kind of genome.
Well, I think that's the important point, is that there are species universals in the way people behave. One of the ideas that I explored in my previous book, The Origins of Virtue, is that we're quite happy with the idea that when people behave antisocially and badly, we say that that's their animal nature. Actually, we don't say that when they behave well and cooperatively and altruistically. And there are good reasons for thinking, looking at the history of the human species.
Altruism is a key word in this whole argument.
Exactly, that altruism could be very much an instinct, not just something that you have to do by overriding your bad instincts. Instincts can be good things as well as bad things, is what I'm saying, in terms of sort of the moral and social debate.
How would moral virtue be built into the genome? Where will we find it?
Well, there are two chromosomes that are fused in human beings compared with apes. The apes have 24 pairs of chromosomes. We have 23. The place where they're fused is at the ends, in the middle of chromosome 2 on ourselves. So I say rather facetiously in the book that maybe that's where the soul is. Maybe that's where humanity lies. I'm being entirely facetious there. Of course, it's not going to be that easy. You're not going to be able to pin down something and say, I found the altruism gene. It's going to be a very complex interaction of a whole number of genes. And I think one of the dangers in this area is to be too simplistic and to try to pin one gene to one concept too often. It's often going to be a complicated interaction. And just to give you just a very simple example of how the environment comes into play, if you do find, say, an alcoholism gene, a gene that seems to be much commoner in alcoholics than in related people who are not alcoholics, then that's still, in a sense, a meaningless gene in someone who doesn't drink. And if you think of the interaction between genes and environment in that way, you get an idea of just how interdependent nature and nurture are.
What are we going to do about the alcoholism gene or the depression gene or the Huntington's disease gene?
Well, I think one of the worries about the way this kind of thing works is that the is diagnosis is running way ahead of therapy. And that's a very good example of that is Huntington's disease. You can now tell from a genetic test pretty well exactly, A, whether you've got the Huntington's disease gene, and B, exactly at what age you're going to get that disease. It's a fantastic piece of sort of horoscope, if you like. Mm. But you can do nothing about it. It's completely incurable. Now, that hopefully will change in the next 10 years. Now that we understand the disease a bit better, we may be able to develop a cure for it. But I think for a long time, we are going to, diagnosis is going to run ahead of therapy. We're going to be able to tell people what problems they're going to encounter, from Alzheimer's to alcoholism to all sorts of things like that, without necessarily being able to treat people so well.
What are the diseases you write about in the book in which you can sort of search the gene of the genome, in effect, and urge people not to marry each other? I mean,
yeah,
that's the easiest sort of manipulation.
Yes. I mean, that's already happening in the sense of genetic screening is being used in certainly in the Jewish community in New York to spot these one or two particular diseases that seem to be commoner in that group and to counsel against particular marriages that would lead to it. I think, you know, we could get into the situation where people have, as it were, a glimpse of their own future from their genes. The question really is going to be whether people want that and whether people would prefer to remain in ignorance. I think in a lot of cases people are going to prefer to remain in ignorance unless it's something you really can do a lot about. Because just because you found a genetic problem doesn't mean that the cure has to be a genetic one. Doesn't mean you have to resort to gene therapy to cure it. There are quite a lot of genetic conditions where you simply have to change your lifestyle to take into account the fact that you've got that genetic propensity.
Well, we come to the point of sort of getting a read on your genes within hours after you're born, and then sort of purging the bad ones or tweaking the leaning ones or adding the missing ones to produce sort of perfect people.
Well, I don't think we will, and the reason I don't think we will, or at least most of us won't use that technology, is because there are going to be so many genes. I mean, at the moment we know a few hundred, so we tend to concentrate on them. We tend to get quite worked up about them. But when we know 80,000 human genes, what's the point of walking into your physician's office and saying, now look, of the 80,000, 40,000 of them are ones I could handle having improved. And he says, well, it's $10,000 a shot, you know. and anyway, I can't be sure how that'll interact with the ones you haven't changed and so on. I think, in a way, swamping people with too much knowledge is the answer to that problem. And it will, on the whole, make us fairly cautious about going down too much of the tweaking route. Mm. It's physically possible to say to someone who carries a very serious genetic condition, or will be physically possible, we can screen your embryos, or we can even genetically engineer your embryos so as to correct that condition. And I think you'd be very hard put to say to someone, that's wrong, you can't do that. Because if it's a very cruel genetic disease, then that has to be right. But at the other end of the spectrum, if somebody comes in saying, I want to make my child more musical or have greater athletic ability, and there's a gene just discovered recently called the ACE gene, which correlates very strongly with physical endurance. And people who climb 8,000-meter mountains without oxygen always have one version of this gene, it turns out, and things like that. Now, you can imagine someone saying, I really want my child to be a mountaineer or a long-distance runner. I'd like that version of that gene. It might happen, in a sense, it's their decision. It's hard for society to come up with rules for saying, this is where we draw the line, but above that line it's enhancement, it's not allowed, below that line it's cure and it is allowed. Do we draw one line? Do we allow people to draw their own lines? How does it work? We're only at the beginning of this debate.
1-800-423-8255 makes the genome connection with the science journalist Matt Ridley, who's written the kind of book-length preface to, he says, the greatest science book that'll ever be written, the operating manual of the human species, the human genome, which will be out within the next year or two. 1-800-423-8255. Everything you wanted to know about the 23 chromosomes, the 80,000 genes, the innumerable letters and variations on what makes our chemistry work. 1-800-423-TALK is the phone. Maria is on the line.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to make a comment that I find that mapping our genome is an utterly disturbing knowledge to me. I think that human nature and our curiosity will result in a terrible misuse of this knowledge. And I think we're playing with something that we shouldn't go into, territory that doesn't belong to us, and that we should tread much more carefully. And the fact that there's so much publicity, and you see it on the radio and on the TV, and it's human nature that we're very fascinated with this topic, and I think that it would tend to create a lot of misuse of the information. With
Maria, you say it very, very well. I'm glad you kick it off just that way. This is too much. This is sort of the Tower of Babel again. We're trying to be God. Matt, really, what about it?
Well, I think two points. One is, we're right to be cautious. We're right, as it were, to listen.
Who says we are cautious? I mean,
well, I think, you know, Maria's expressing what a lot of people think, which is that we've got to be very careful as we step into this new technology. On the other hand, can you really look someone with terminal cancer in the eye and say we should not have found out about the P53 gene, which is the most crucial tumor suppressing gene, and which opens the best option for curing cancer, for actually turning it round? You know, the point is that once we embark on this knowledge, the moral turn our backs on knowledge is not necessarily it can be a morally capable, a culpable act as well. You know, you could actually be abandoning possibilities for making people healthier and happier.
Maria, do you want to answer that?
Well, I just like to comment that I just disagree. I hope that as a nation and as a society, that we don't want to continue to always find out more and more knowledge that just continually results in misuse. I'm in the environmental profession, and I see that we have lots of chemicals and lots of things that help make our lives easier, it may seem. But in the end, we find groundwater pollution. We find things that we have to constantly deal with the repercussions of. I just hope that as a society we look and tread very carefully into this area, and perhaps.
Point taken. Maria, thank you very much. 1-800-423-8255. Andrew is calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Hi, I'm a chemistry student at Brown University, and I'd like to address a misconception that some people seem to have about the Human Genome Project. Specifically, Mr. Lydon, you just mentioned that it's everything we'd ever want to know about the human genome. And I think that's really not true, because what a lot of people don't realize is that genes are simply a code to the linear structure of proteins. And proteins are what gets a lot of our body's work done. But they do that after they're made in a linear structure, and then they fold up. And they fold up in ways that we completely can't understand. And their function comes directly from the way in which they fold up, which we don't know anything about. So in that sense, when we have the entire genome mapped out, we'll have a map of things that a map of this linear structure of proteins, but we don't really have any idea what the proteins do. So in that sense, we'll know where all the genes are, but we're not going to have any idea what they do. In that sense, I think the Human Genome Project is really a lot more of a starting point than a ending point in our understanding of the human genome.
Andrew, you know more about it than I do, but Matt, really, what about the point?
Yeah, I don't disagree that this is the beginning and not the end. I absolutely think that's a fundamental point. You know, just finding the sequence of a gene doesn't necessarily tell you very much about it, and often the only thing we know about a gene is what disease you get when it goes wrong, which is like knowing the only thing about a heart is that you can get a heart attack from it. But, you know, take the example of a gene on chromosome 19 called the ApoE gene. We now know that if you change the 334th letter from A to G, you increase people's chances of getting Alzheimer's disease by 11 times if they get two copies of that gene versus two copies of the other kind. Now, that is, you know, is seriously important and relevant knowledge, and it shows that at bottom, we are dealing with a digital system. Sure, there's an analog element to it later on in how it's expressed, but the massive discovery of 1953 was that the secret of life is actually a piece of digital code of a kind we can read, we can edit, we can understand. Now, you know, there's complications to add later on, but just changing one letter in an 897 letter gene can make a difference.
Andrew, could I ask you, what does the coiling, the individual coiling of that strand have to do with it?
Well, most of the proteins that our body makes are what's called enzymes, and these sort of help molecular reactions along that maybe wouldn't occur otherwise. And the way our body functions is all based on what chemical reactions are going on inside of it. So these enzymes cause the chemical reactions to work. Whether or not the enzymes work depends on whether or not, or depends on exactly what way these enzymes are shaped. They literally sort of pick molecules up and put them together. And as I said, turns out that this problem of protein folding is actually the most difficult computational problem that anybody is addressing right now.
That'll be volume two, Andrew. I mean, it's good to be corrected. Thank you. We're talking about the human genome, the great study of human genes, started by the government, pursued wildly by in private enterprise. It'll be out within a year or two. Matt Ridley's got a look at the first draft. We'll be back. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. From Boston University, this is... I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Matt Ridley is our guest. His new book is called Genome, the Autobiography of a Species in 23 chapters. We have something like 80,000 human genes on 23 pairs of chromosomes. Take one of the 23, Matt Ridley, and tell us what it tells us.
Well, one of the really interesting pairs is, of course, the sex chromosomes, the X and Y in men and the XX in people. In women.
They are people.
Yeah, it's the other way around in birds. That's what I was thinking there. It's XY in females and XX in males. But what's interesting about those is that on the Y chromosome, you get the masculinizing gene, the main one that sort of sets off the trigger of turning you into a man. If that's missing, you become a woman, whether or not you've got XY. It turns out that the more we understand about the way the X and Y chromosomes behave, the more we're beginning to realize that genes that are good for women are not necessarily good for men, and they tend to accumulate on the X chromosome. And genes that are good for men are not necessarily good for women can accumulate on the Y chromosome. Now,
what does it mean to be a gene that's not good for men or women? What are you talking
about? Well, now, this is where things get interesting. We haven't pinned down any very obvious human ones yet, but in fruit flies and other animals, we've found genes that are good at protecting the egg against sperm and genes that are good at allowing sperm into the egg, for example. And you find there's a sort of conflict builds up between these. And if you actually allow evolution to run in the female line but not in the male line, you end up with... in the male line but not in the female line, you actually end up with males which produce sperm that's actually toxic to females and actually can poison them. It's a weird and scary world this we're entering, and we begin to realize that sexual conflict goes right into the genes. Now, where this could have applications, if you talk about homosexuality in people, it's possible that what we may be looking at in the genes that influence homosexuality is not purely inherited, but it seems to have a fairly high hereditary component. What we may be looking at is a sexually antagonistic pair of genes, a gene that when it's in females is good for female fertility. When it's in males, by making them homosexual, it's bad for for male fertility, for the number of children that a man is likely to produce. It, you know, it may enhance attractiveness or intelligence or something like that, but at the expense of homosexuality, which in natural selection terms means that it's likely to get rarer. Mm. But it doesn't get rarer because it's also good for female fertility, so when it's in women, it actually boosts the fertility back up again. You get the idea of how a system like that works. It's, at the moment, nobody's saying that that's definitely what the so-called gay genes might turn out to be, but it's an example of the kinds of things we're finding in them.
What does the... what you're calling the sexual antagonism of genes have to do with what we call the war of the sexes?
Well, you could argue that it's just an analogy and that what's happening down there in the genes is nothing to do with what happens in the way people interact, which has a lot more cultural overtones, obviously. But to some extent, of course, it's just another expression of the fact that men and women are sometimes after different things, and that there is an inevitable conflict between the way they approach the world, which stems from the major asymmetry between the size of the egg and the size of the sperm, if you like.
The phone is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the human genome with the British journalist Matt Ridley. 1-800-423-8255. Hillel is calling from the road.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about alcoholism as a genetic disorder. Whenever I hear it, I tend to bristle because it's such a complex set of activities, and to say that someone picking up a bottle, putting it to their lips, or going to the liquor store is genetically determined just seems a little bit counterintuitive to me. So I wondered if you could comment on, you know, just what is the more elemental behavior activity that you think is genetically determined when it comes to alcoholism?
Yeah, well, I agree with you. I think, and that was really the point I was making, is that you can't, even with a gene for alcoholism, you can't be an alcoholic unless you drink. But I think there is fairly good evidence that different types of personality can run in families, that you can have hereditary tendency towards things like addiction, and you can even get quite specific biochemical differences in the extent to which you get addicted to alcohol. And, you know, these vary in proportion in different races, for example, so that some people who've been exposed to alcohol for much longer, i.e., you know, more thousands of years, seem to have less tendency to have problems with addiction. And that may well have a genetic component, which has been fed in through the culture.
But he's also asking, what's the connection between some sort of appetite or deficiency or need that could be inherited, and then those behaviors like putting that Ripple bottle, you know, to your mouth too much or whatever. I mean, it's sort of like the obesity gene. How does something like that translate to, you know, just ingesting butter? With a sort of endless appetite.
So I think in kind of general parlance, we talk about alcohol, the disease of alcoholism, when people might be wanting to speak metaphorically, but it's now entered into our general conversation as a literal disease, when really what as you said, the most we're talking about is perhaps a temperamental disposition towards novelty-seeking, towards, you know, some sort of excitement or risky behavior. And in some people, that translates into alcoholism. Some people, it's more benign, and it's just skydiving.
I mean, yeah, exactly. And in the case of obesity or something like that, you would get, you might well find that. I mean, there are some people who simply don't feel full at the end of a meal. You know, there's something wrong with the genetic program of satiation, and that leads them to eat too much. So there are all sorts of different ways in which our underlying biology can predispose us in different directions behaviorally. Just because it's complicated and just because there's environmental interactions involved doesn't mean we can rule out innate connections to it as well, I think.
I agree with that, though I think there are fairly profound implications for moral responsibility from this sort of genetic work. So I think
absolutely,
we have to be very careful in, you know, how we characterize what the genetic influence is.
Well, that's absolutely true, and you get the problem of genes becoming an excuse. And we've already seen one case where somebody has said that their criminal behavior may or may not have been due to a criminal gene running in their family, in which case they are not responsible for their actions. We've already, of course, used that. The courts have worked out ways of dealing with that argument in terms of insanity, in terms of other environmental influences, whether or not it was justifiable revenge or rage or something that caused someone to commit a crime. In a sense, genes are no different. They do, they pose this problem of responsibility, but... And if you like, responsibility is a fiction. If we're determined creatures, you can always say that there are causes for your behavior. But it's a fiction that the law has to maintain.
Hello, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the genome connection. Cecile is on the line.
Oh, hi. Yes. I hear that people with Down syndrome have an extra chromosome. And I was wondering what else is on that chromosome and how, I guess, evolutionarily speaking, that happened.
Yeah, well, actually, what people with Down syndrome have is an extra chromosome 21. Chromosome 21 is the smallest of the chromosomes, and it has probably the fewest genes on it. And that's, in a sense, why we see people with Down syndrome in the world and not people with extra other chromosomes. If you have an extra chromosome 13, you can actually be born, but you don't live very long. All the other chromosomes, having an extra one is just too big a maladjustment of the development, and it simply doesn't work. So in a sense, what we're seeing there is the only chromosome you can get away with having an extra one and still be a viable person. One of the interesting things is that people with Down syndrome do actually get very early Alzheimer's. I mean, it's quite a common feature is to get Alzheimer's quite early in life, and that suggests that there are genes on chromosome 21 that could teach us a bit about Alzheimer's. We don't quite know where they are or what.
What's the process that kicks in an extra chromosome?
Well, it's related to the age of the mother, and nobody quite knows why. But when the chromosomes are being sort of segregated, the pairs are being separated so that you get half a set for the egg. It turns out that it again gets sort of suspended for 20, 30, 40 years during the mother's life in a sort of half segregated form. And it turns out if you restart that process again in an older mother, there's quite a good chance of two of the chromosomes going into the egg instead of just one of them. If that's chromosome 21, then you increase your chances of having a baby with Down syndrome.
1-800-423-8255 makes the genome connection with the science writer and the author, Matt Ridley. 1-800-423-8255. So much of this argument is about not just the physical things, height, color of hair, eyes, but about social behavior. And emotional behavior, happiness even, serenity, contentment, not to mention intelligence. Connection listeners, how much are we willing to begin to understand that these terribly subtle sort of interconnections may be forecast in certain ways and by our genes and may be inherited from our parents? 1-800-423-TALK is the phone. Byron is on the line.
Excellent program, Chris.
Thank you, Byron. It's an excellent book.
Well, I may get to it. I'm a physician, which has nothing to do with insight. But I question whether or not the blueprint versus function is implicit in the statement that your guest made earlier about memorizing a phone number. In other words, it's not the gene, in my view, that helps to memorize the phone number. It's nerve cells.
Yes, but if you examine how nerve cells change to memorize the phone number, they actually strengthen and weaken connections. And the strengthening and weakening of connections is caused by the switching on and off of genes on chromosomes inside those nerve cells. That literally is part of the process. The genes were found in fruit flies. The first one that was found was called Dunce, because when it was missing, the fruit fly failed to learn a simple task. Which is a bit pejorative, but it's one of the great surprises of the study of memory is the discovery of the extent to which the rapid switching on and off of genes is actually part of the process of laying down the memory.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. I shall have to look into that further. It runs rather contrary to my ancient medical education.
Well, me too, and I hadn't come across this story until I started reading about it. There's actually another very good book on specifically that issue called Time, Love, Memory by Jonathan Weiner. I don't know if you've come across that.
Byron, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Lynn is on the line.
Yes, hi. I want to say, first of all, that I find the topics of environment and genetics absolutely fascinating. And I think that with certain behaviors like drinking, for instance, that or just obscure behaviors or abnormal behaviors, that they are not as familial as they appear genetically. I think that they're really learned. I think they're truly environmental. And I think that we learn from our parents and from our families from a very, very, very early age, preschool, and that they become established so firmly in our personalities that they almost appear to be genetic when in reality they are learned from the environment.
For example, tell us the kind of thing you're talking about now.
All right, let's go to sort of behaviors that maybe are associated with oral fixation, such as overeating and smoking and drinking. Anything that, say, would go into the mouth that is basically... Those behaviors are learned early in life from people in the environment to reduce anxiety. And I think that that's what most of these types of behaviors are. They're really, we're looking to reduce anxiety in our life. We've learned inappropriate and ineffective behaviors in order to deal with that, such as smoking, drinking, could even be serial killing. You know, it could be violence in the family that has tangented off into something as severe as serial killing. But the point is, I think that these behaviors are so strong that they appear genetic when they're really totally
in. Then these things have been studied in terms of environmental genetic influences. Matt, what's the answer?
Well, I think that the recent data is going the other way. It's re-examining the cases where we thought what we were seeing was early learning. And it's finding that actually, once you take into account the possibility that there's inherited predispositions here, there's no evidence for early learning at all. Particularly the work of Judy Rich Harris, whose book, The Nurture Assumption, reveals how she completely turned her mind round on this, having written textbooks about how important nurture was. She then started to look at the evidence and where the studies have controlled for the fact that you actually inherit things from your parents as well as learn things from your parents, there it becomes clear that the learning things from your background just doesn't come out of the studies as being an important thing at all. I don't think that's a sort of bleak idea. In fact, I mean, I think I find it slightly reassuring that the way we behave is to some extent dependent on who we are rather than what other people make of us. In a sense, genes are inside us, they're part of us, whereas environmental influences are a form of brainwashing, they're someone else. Now, this doesn't mean that peer pressure particularly, the influence of the environment from other people of our own age is not important, but it does...
But I wonder if you can give examples to confront Lens of sort of oral fixation. I mean, that can mean many things, but she's talking about smoking.
She gave the example of how it's often a response to anxiety. Well, the anxiety itself may be partly innate. So in a sense, what you're seeing is a sort of fairly predictable reaction to an innate capacity, the anxiety. And another good example, I think, is the pattern of a withdrawn father and an overprotective mother in a family with a homosexual child. Now, that pattern does stand up to scrutiny, but when you examine the dynamics of families, it becomes pretty clear that what's happening is that the father's reaction and the father's reaction to the evidence of the child's lack of interest in masculine things, and then the mother's reaction to the father's reaction. So in other words, the arrow of causation is going from the behavior to the reaction, not the other way around. Cause and effect got muddled up in that.
Lynn, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the genome connection with Matt Ridley. Ruth is calling from the road in Rhode Island.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Welcome, Ruth.
I wanted to tell you, this is a story that's been told, I know, but I have a half-sister whom I did not meet, nor did I know about her, until we were in our late 20s, early 30s. Hmm. And we have a lot of very interesting things in common that we started figuring out right off the bat. An example of that is that we wear the same perfumes, and there are two perfumes that are not really common. And the first time I walked into her room and I saw the same perfumes, you know, or we both studied the same things in college. We both studied philosophy and art history, although we come from a gene pool, if you will, of scientists. Our common parent is our father, and our mothers were all scientists, and yet we have this very strong connection and interest in art. And as it turns out, my father's father and grandfather were photographers and daguerreotypers, and so we, of course, suspect that our aesthetic inclinations come through that gene heritage. So that's been a very interesting process of discovery for us.
Yeah. What do you find you don't share?
Politics. Our politics are different. One of us is a conservative, one is much more liberal.
There you go. That was one of the things I said would turn out not to be genetic. Thank you.
we both come from families that are, I think, quite analytical, and yet we both have very spiritual parts of our lives. You know, one of us is quite religious, the other very spiritual in other ways. So, I was just trying to think of things we don't share, but honestly, right off the bat, I can't think of obvious things. She swears more than I do.
You have a common father, and he never told you about her.
No, we didn't find out until I was about 30.
Interesting.
Because he didn't know where she was, and it wasn't until she chose to find her birth parents.
There are lots of stories like this, Ruth, especially of identical twins separated at birth. What do we learn?
The evidence from particularly Thomas Bouchard's study in Minnesota of identical twins separated at birth is what's really, I think, shook psychology to its roots over the last 20 years. And that's, you know, that you find people who've been separated at birth who are identical twins, and you find many, many more similarities in things you would never think of as being genetic than you expected. But, of course, that's a very indirect
way. Okay, so you take the twins, I mean, they are the same genetic material, you separate them, bring them back 20, 30, 40 years later. What do you see in the correspondence of, say, politics or spirituality or artistic preference or intelligence or social role?
Well, I mean, you hear all these stories about how they ended up in the same career. They married women with the same names. They had the same kind of dog and things like that. I don't read too much into that. I think there's a certain amount of coincidence going on there. But I mean, IQ is the classic one. If you test people's IQ, it turns out that two people taking the same IQ taking an IQ test twice get an 87% correlation between their scores on different times. On average, if you get identical twins, separated or not separated, to take the same IQ test, they get about 86% correlation. and so on down the line. And if you then find people who are unrelated but have been reared in the same household, and you look for the correlation between them in their performance on an IQ test, it's maybe 10, 15%. It's a huge difference.
But the suggestion being that genes are all...
No, genes are not all. There's definitely a large role for the environment. I mean, the figures I've given there might imply that, but that's not actually the way it comes out once you do the statistics properly. There's definitely a role for the environment. The interesting thing is that the role for the environment seems to decrease as we get older. Now, you might think it'd be the other way around, that the environment would have more and more influence on us. But in fact, when you're maybe 10 years old, the environment can have quite a big influence on how you do an IQ test. By the time you're 50 years old, you're expressing your own personality. You've given up being subject to other people's influences to a large extent. And in a sense, your genes are showing through more, not less, which is an interesting discovery.
What about designer babies? What about the eugenic temptation here with all this knowledge?
That is the big worry, the big issue. I think if I look at the history of eugenics in the first half of the last century, as we must learn to call it,
pretty appalling history.
It's a terrifying history, and what was particularly upsetting about it was the degree of coercion, the degree to which the government said in various countries, including this one, that breeding must become part of national planning. And was, you know, society's need must override the individual's interest. And that's what we've got to be very careful to avoid. We must allow the individual interest to be paramount over any desire that society must have.
Hmm. Even of imperfect people.
If people want to bring imperfect people into the world, so long as they don't do it cruelly, that's up to them.
Matt, really, it's a fascinating subject, and we're all going to have to learn an awful lot more about it, but I think your book is a brilliant way to start. Genome, the Autobiography of a Species in 23 Chapters by our guest, Matt Ridley. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Funding for The Connection comes from the Allaire Corporation. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by David's Moving and Storage, Inc., relocating individuals and corporations on a national and local level, including Canada. 800-239-3388 or on